Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As President Obama settles into his Martha's Vineyard vacation, there's a flurry of news today about how his administration might deal with terrorism suspects. Later today, the CIA is expected to release a 2004 report detailing the brutal treatment of suspects during Bush-era CIA interrogations, including confirmation of a leaked story that at least one detainee was threatened with a gun and a power drill. Well, today, an aide says Obama has approved the creation of a new government unit to interrogate suspects. And the Justice Department is recommending that Attorney General Eric Holder reopen an investigation into prisoner abuse cases, something the White House today said would be solely up to Holder. Mark Mazzetti is National Security Correspondent for The New York Times. Mark, start there. Tell us more about these cases.
There have been about two dozen cases over the years that the CIA Inspector General referred to the Justice Department for prosecution. During the Bush administration, Justice Department declined to prosecute. And these were not political prosecutors who looked at these, but really career prosecutors in the Eastern District of Virginia. What my colleague David Johnson reported today is that there's an ethics office in the Justice Department that has relooked at that and is now advising Attorney General Holder to relook at those cases. In other words, open them up again and see whether there's enough evidence to prosecute.
Well, and what does all of this mean? President Obama has said he doesn't want to pursue prosecution of Bush-era officials in potential abuse interrogations. What does this mean if Attorney General Eric Holder is considering reopening them?
It creates some tension, certainly. Eric Holder has said, you know, regardless of what the White House wants, it's my job as the nation's top law enforcement official to investigate wrongdoing where it happens. Now, President Obama did leave the door open to go after CIA interrogators who went beyond official Justice Department guidelines.
Well, and you've already reported on the use of a power tool and a gun in interrogations. We're expected to hear more about that later today. Would that be illegal? Would that go beyond the rules?
Yes, we believe they did. Earlier this year, the Justice Department memos came out that sort of laid out exactly what the techniques, the approved techniques were. Those were not part of the approved techniques. So presumably, things that were done beyond those techniques certainly would leave open the possibility that whoever did that could be investigated by the Justice Department.
And then how far does it go? Does the actual interrogator say, but I thought that I was given permission to do that by Bush officials?
Well, this is where it gets very, I think, dicey for the Obama administration. They certainly want to keep any future prosecution in a very narrow box. However, if you're a defense attorney of someone who they investigate, they no doubt will try to push responsibility up the chain of command. As we know, these interrogations, CIA interrogations, were approved at the highest level, including President Bush, Vice President Cheney. There's a lot of paper, as they say, memos going back and forth approving this stuff. So it does seem hard for the Justice Department to keep it in the narrow box of only interrogators who went beyond approved methods. It would seem that it might expand beyond that.
Yeah. And what about going forward? There are reports that President Obama has approved a new high-value detainee interrogation group, which will be known by the acronym HIG, which will take over interrogations from the CIA. First of all, how does the CIA feel about that, and what more do we know about that group?
Well, I mean, they've certainly been hinting at this for some time, that they would be sort of having a class of government interrogators, not just FBI interrogators or CIA interrogators, but have sort of one uniform standard. The CIA, for all intents and purposes, has kind of been out of the interrogation business for a number of years. We don't believe there's any high-value detainees currently in CIA custody. And so we got the sense from Director of National Intelligence Dennis Blair, for instance, earlier this year, who said the best thing to do would be to take the skills learned by the CIA, by the FBI, by the military, and create and train a group of interrogators who follow non-coercive interrogation guidelines, but also who get the experience and take it out of just one agency.
Well, and we're reading some reports that the CIA might actually be relieved to be relieved of that job. But tell us more about HIG. We understand they'd rely only on the Army Field Manual. What does that mean as far as what they might be able to do in interrogations?
Well, the Army Field Manual is right now what the military uses for its interrogations. And it is a very limited slate of interrogation methods. This would then become the standard for all government interrogations. As we know, during the Bush administration, there was a carve-out for the CIA to do more coercive interrogation methods because the belief was that high-value detainees, it was needed on high-value detainees, that they had trained against the Army Field Manual, and so therefore would not give up information. Now it's being reported that the new class of government interrogators would rely solely on this Army Field Manual.
Which would mean, for instance, I mean, waterboarding has been banned, but what else wouldn't be allowed?
Sleep deprivation, you know, forced nudity, manipulation of diet, that type of thing.
Yeah. That's Mark Mazzetti, National Security Correspondent for The New York Times. Mark, thank you so much.
Okay, thanks so much.
Okay, before there was Walmart, there was Ames Department Store. Now, if you live in, say, rural Pennsylvania, you know this chain that brought discount retailing to rural areas. In fact, Ames was the fourth largest U.S. retailer in the 80s. Today, it's out of business. And how about A&P? It was the grocery chain on New York's Long Island. A&P, in fact, had 10,000 stores in the mid-50s and outsold its nearest rival by $1 billion. Today, A&P has just 500 stores. What led to the downfall of these and other once great companies? It's a question worth asking in today's economic climate. And management expert Jim Collins does ask the question in his new book, How the Mighty Fall. Jim Collins' much acclaimed earlier books, Built to Last and Good to Great, were about how good companies become great. Today, his thoughts on how they collapse. Jim joins us from KGN Public Radio in his hometown of Boulder, Colorado. Jim, welcome.
Very pleased to be here with you, Robin.
And we understand, you know, the timing of your book would seem to be serendipitous, but you started a long time ago looking at this. In fact, your wife, she was going through a bout with breast cancer. Now, I'm sure your first thoughts weren't about a business analogy.
No.
And we're glad to hear that she's made it through. But gradually, you started to see, wait a second, here's this person, your wife, who looked spectacular on the outside and had a disease on the inside.
I realized in retrospect that at the very moment that she looked the picture of health, she must have already been sick. And that's when the whole thing kind of came together of, you know, maybe really any kind of decline has the seeds inside, even though on the outside you look the picture of health. And then that translated over to, well, maybe some of the great companies and great enterprises that have fallen, maybe they looked the pictures of health, but they were already sick.
Right. Tell us about what you saw as the five stages of decline.
First of all, I want to be very clear about the really scary part of this. You don't look to everybody else like you're sick, like you're falling, until stage four. So you go through the first three stages, in fact, almost appearing to others at your very height of strength and power and greatness, and yet that silent creep of impending doom. You're right on the edge of it, and you're about to go over a cliff. That's what's really scary. So stage one is hubris born of success. And this is when your very success leads you to become arrogant about your success and to ultimately lose sight of the real factors that brought you success in the first place. And additionally, you begin to feel that your success is deserved rather than accepting the fact that you might have been more lucky than good. And so therefore, you always need to be that somewhat neurotic paranoid to make yourself stronger for the day that your luck might run out.
Let's give a quick example that you give of stage one, Motorola, which developed a StarTAC phone in 95 that had analog technology. Wireless carriers were all going digital. Motorola, instead of seeing that train leaving the station, stayed with the StarTAC phone.
Motorola was truly one of the greatest enterprises of the 20th century. And as it became more and more successful, it began to display those elements of arrogance. I mean, if you think about what hubris is, right, it's outrageous arrogance that inflicts suffering upon the innocent, to quote J. Rufus Fears, who's a classics professor. And of course, then that can lead you to discount information. Well, nobody wouldn't want our products, for example. Another form of arrogance that shows up is when you begin to inflict arrogant neglect. You think that you can turn your attention to exciting new adventures, perhaps because you're bored, perhaps because you are looking for some kind of new arena of growth, and you turn your back on what made you successful in the first place. And that was the story of Circuit City. It inflicted arrogant neglect upon its Circuit City superstores, and when it finally turned back to try to renew them, they had been clobbered by two words, Best Buy.
Well, so that's stage one. Stage two, undisciplined pursuit of more.
Yes. You would think that what happens to a great enterprise is that you become complacent, you become fat, you become lazy, you become corpulent. You just kind of lay around and do nothing new or interesting, and the world just passes you by, and you never change, you never innovate anymore. Well, in fact, we didn't find that this is how the mighty fall. It may be the way mediocre enterprises fall, but it's not how the great ones fall. It's overreaching. It's going too far, too much growth, too much innovation, too much aggression, too much going for the big bet, for the gigantic leap out into the future that is uncalibrated. And so, for example, if you look at a case of a company like Rubbermaid, they were introducing a new product every single day, 365 days a year, while seeking to enter new categories every 12 to 18 months. I don't describe that as complacency. And yet, they fell. Think about everything that just happened in the whole financial crisis that we went through, which isn't what we studied because it hadn't happened when we started our research. But it'd be very hard to argue that we got into it because of a lack of financial aggression or a lack of financial innovation. It was, in fact, going too much risk, too much aggression.
Well, let's go to the next stage, denial of risk and peril. Now, you give a couple of examples of how in and out of business, people ask the wrong question. One of the examples is a terrible but instructive story of mountain climbers who are on the side of a mountain, and instead of asking, what's the worst thing that could happen if we stay, said, what's the best thing that could happen if we stay? You know, we get to finish our climb. And one of the climbers was what? Struck by lightning.
That's right. The example I give there has to do with the aspect of what we would call, you know, asymmetric risk, which basically means this. What's the upside if we're right? And what's the downside if we bet and we're wrong? Now, in some cases, they play off each other, and even if things go wrong, you're still going to be fine. But in the case of the climbers, this big thunderstorm looks like it was going to be rolling into the canyon. Now, think about these questions. What's the upside if we go to the top today and begin working on the top of the climb? Well, the upside is we've spent some time working on the climb, and it'll accelerate us the next time we come, and maybe we complete our planned outing for the day. There's some upside in that. But what's the downside? When you see that evidence growing, you see the peril coming, you see the storm gathering, and what happens if it turns into a full-fledged lightning storm and it's the top of a pinnacle there? The consequence can be catastrophic. And that's exactly what happened. The lightning bolt struck, the gear melted, the climbers died, or one of the climbers died. And any time you have this kind of denial of peril or denial of brutal facts, denial of evidence, and or sometimes the real key is it's really how you interpret. You can interpret evidence as either positive or negative. And what we found, and I know it's not necessarily a healthy response to the world, but it is the productive paranoids who do well in a scary world. It's the ones who look at a piece of data and they say, well, we could see that as positive, or we could see that as negative. Let's assume, if we don't know otherwise, that it's negative act accordingly.
Jim Collins, author of How the Mighty Fall, Five Stages of Decline. When we come back, the final two stages. Also later, Small Business, a program for novice farmers, is putting food on their table, but also some pretty exotic fare in the markets. Have you had pumpkin greens? That's later, but we'll be back in a minute with Jim Collins, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our talk with Jim Collins, author of How the Mighty Fall. He says he's identified five stages of decline in business. We spoke about the first three: hubris, born of success, undisciplined pursuit of more, and denial of risk and peril. Now we're to stage four, grasping for salvation, sort of desperation. Jim, you say the first three stages result in stage four.
Stages one, two, and three accumulate. Hubris born of success, undisciplined pursuit of more, denial of risk and peril, but you're still looking okay. And then all of a sudden it all catches up and boom, you're falling. And everybody knows you're falling and you know you're falling. And the question is, how do you respond? Do you respond by going back to a very disciplined and methodical approach that made you great in the first place, or do you respond by grasping for salvation? And it's when you react by grasping for salvation, which can be, we need the game-saving acquisition, we need a breakthrough technology that's going to fix everything tomorrow, we need the charismatic, heroic, visionary leader who's going to come in and point the way and save us, right? Any of these versions of a silver bullet are grasping for salvation.
Bringing in outside people, bringing in big name CEOs, miracle workers, and you make the point that it's rare that someone from outside a company saves a company?
Absolutely. In this study, those who went for outsiders, usually performance worsened when they did so, and companies often get themselves out of trouble with insiders. Now, I want to be very clear. This doesn't mean that an outsider can't succeed. I think, let me just, though, very briefly talk about an insider that, to me, is one of the great heroes of American business in the last decade, and that's Anne Mulcahy of Xerox. Xerox was in stage four. Xerox was in tremendous trouble. Their stock had plummeted. They were facing an investigation. They were losing market share. At the time that she was announced, nobody knew who she was, and she was the antithesis of the hero who rides in from the outside. She was the one who came from the inside. And when everybody said, you have to be the contrary and smash this culture to save it, and she said, I am the culture. And if you think I need to smash the culture and smash the people, you have the wrong person. And she built it systematically from there and gave Xerox its soul back.
What did she do? Just give us a quick thumbnail.
Well, the first thing she did was to look at it and say, it's not about me. And that's one of the things that the greatest leaders we've studied understand. Anne was very much in it for Xerox first. Second, she looked around and she said, I need to make sure that I put in place in my key seats the right people. We found with the very best leaders, they say, no, I don't know where we should drive this bus. I'm not brilliant enough to know the answer to that question. So I first have to get the right people on the bus, the right people in the key seats, and then as a group, we will figure out where to drive it. And the third thing she did was she stripped everything away and said, we are not going to be in denial anymore. What are the brutal facts?
Right.
And what Anne brought, and it's something that actually comes from good to great, but boy, it would apply in stage four, and it's called the Stockdale Paradox. And it comes from Jim Stockdale, the highest-ranking military officer in the Hanoi Hilton in Vietnam, 67 to 74, tortured over 20 times. When I asked Admiral Stockdale, who didn't make it out as strong as you? And he said, oh, that's easy. It was the optimists. I had faith in the end game. But the optimists, they were always the ones who said, we're going to be out by Christmas. And Christmas would come and Christmas would go. And it would come and it would go again. And they died of a broken heart.
It was blind optimism.
It was the opposite of what Stockdale said when he grabbed me by the shoulders and he said, you must never, ever confuse unwavering faith that you'll find a way out with the need to confront the most brutal facts. We're not out of here by Christmas. That's what Anne did at Xerox. She said, I have unwavering faith. We will not capitulate. We will not give up. We will find a way out of this. But the only way is we have to accept we're not going to be out of here by Christmas, and we have a ton of brutal facts. And that's what these leaders do, is they put those two things together. And it's a very stoic yet deeply faithful approach.
Well, Jim Collins, author of How the Mighty Fall, a couple last questions for you. First of all, two of the companies you profiled in your book, Good to Great, have faced catastrophe. Circuit City is out of business. Fannie Mae saved by the federal government. Were you wrong about them?
No, and I think that's what makes it even more scary. They were great, and they fell. And that's what's so absolutely terrifying. If they can fall, if Zenith can fall, if A&P can fall, then anyone can fall. We are all potentially vulnerable, and I come away very sobered, and I think I will always be a paranoid.
On the other hand, as you write about these companies, Merck, the drug company, Hewlett-Packard, these are companies that you point out had been founded on missions. In Merck's case, for instance, a mission to help people be healthy. In fact, I think the founder said,
preserve and improve human life.
Right. Yep. And it's not about making money. And
that's
in
right.
each case, just about every case, new leaders abandoned that mission and looked only to growth. We know that you are read passionately by business people in business schools. And I guess the question is, why do you need a book to tell people, don't be greedy? Don't be greedy.
Well,
you know, have a mission other than make money and be big.
Well, you know, I guess this is a great kind of question for us to end on, because despite the dark journey, I come away deeply hopeful because of, one, we found that as long as you only go to stage four, you can come back. And the truly great people like George Merck II, he deeply believed medicine is for the patient. David Packard of HP deeply believed in building a culture that would make technical contributions that would make the world work better. Motorola's founder, Robert Galvin, believed in the incredible power of human creativity and human renewal. Walt Disney wanted very much to bring happiness to millions of people. And yes, you can be successful without having a purpose beyond just making money. But the truly great ones always understand that money and profits and growth follow from having a purpose that is much larger than that and a set of values that they adhere to. And to me, what I see is this young generation of leaders coming. And my own view is I'm deeply hopeful because I think they are people who want to do much more than be successful. They want to build companies. They want to build enterprises that ultimately become movements that ultimately make a much bigger difference than, hey, I was here and I made a lot of money.
That's Jim Collins, author of How the Mighty Fall, now on the New York Times Top 10 Business Books list. Jim, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And a quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, Newsweek calls him Obama's Nobel headache, liberal economist Paul Krugman. Also, the children diagnosed with autism in the 80s are now adults. A major hospital has started a program just for them. That's tomorrow. We'll be back after the latest news, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com, and the Institute of Contemporary Art on Boston's waterfront, presenting the work of a diverse range of contemporary artists, performers, and more, icaboston.org.
If you want to take advantage of the government's popular Cash for Clunkers program, the doors on the deal close at 8 p.m. Eastern Time tonight. This means the rebate paperwork on the purchase of a new, more fuel-efficient vehicle, one that averages under 18 miles a gallon, has to be submitted by then. Micheline Maynard of the New York Times had a very helpful Q&A about the end of the program, so we asked Mickey to join us from Detroit. And Mickey, first of all, let's underscore, the deadline is 8 p.m. East Coast time, so what does that mean for the West?
That's right, Robin. So 5 p.m. California time and, you know, everything
right
in between and the time zones in between.
Right. So know that. Less time out west. So, and what's the next big thing you want potential car buyers to know?
One thing people better know is that a lot of dealers have stopped participating already, so they need to check with the dealers where they want to shop to make sure that they're still taking part.
Yeah. And what if the car that you want, let's say you're happy, you're ready to make the purchase, because the purchase has to be made, everything has to be signed and the T's and crossed and the I's dotted by 8, so, or East Coast time.
Yes.
But what if you do all that, but your car isn't there?
Well, the program was amended to allow people to apply the Cash for Clunkers rebate to cars that they order. You know, it may take a while for the car to come in. For example, one of the most popular cars is the Toyota Prius, and they only have a couple of days' worth of inventory of that nationwide. So if you want something and you're willing to order it, they will allow you to apply for the rebate.
Okay, let's get to some of the sticky questions and the things people worry about. You have to qualify for this, but whose responsibility is that qualification? In other words, if you go through the deal, you give the dealer the information, you think you've bought the car, can you then be later rejected for the rebate?
Well, in fact, most applications have been rejected in the first couple of weeks of the deal. The Center for Auto Safety said that up to 80% of the applications are being sent back. The responsibility is ultimately on the dealer to make sure that all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed, but you can help them because, first of all, you need to have valid insurance in a number of states. You need to have, obviously, the registration for the clunker that you're turning in. So if you can come to the dealership with all that paperwork in hand, that will help quite a bit.
Well, and you give even more information. Make sure you don't have any outstanding traffic tickets, no liens on your car. That could get your application kicked back. But what if the dealer has made a mistake, sent you through when, in fact, your car, you really aren't qualified for this? I guess the question still is, can you down the road be told by the dealer, you owe me $4,500? the rebate?
Well, you can be asked for the money back. And in fact, this has been a bone of a lot of discussion with my readers at the New York Times about, you know, can a dealer legally ask you, for example, to reimburse them if the car doesn't go through? The dealer can certainly ask you, and some dealers are asking people to sign contingency agreements up front. So if you are given one, consumer advocates are saying, don't sign them. Dealers are saying, hey, look, you know, this is a lot of our time and effort and money, and we really don't think we can make a deal with you unless you're willing to put up the cash, give us back the cash that you got.
And again, if you don't sign that thing, and you're saying consumer advocates recommend that you don't, and you think everything's square and you've done everything right, but somehow you get kicked back and the dealer, as you said, does ask you for that rebate back, do you legally have to give it to him?
Well, you have to make sure of one thing, that your car is in storage at the dealership. And, you know, the cars have to be destroyed. Essentially, they're pouring something like nuts and bolts into the engines to seize the engine, so these cars cannot be drivable.
Resold,
so make
right.
sure that you insist, you know, until you hear back that everything has gone well, that your car be put in storage. Now, dealers may not like to do this, and you can't blame them, because this has been a very popular program. They'd have a lot of cars in storage if they had to do that. But to protect yourself the most, you know, honestly, you really have to look out for this and be vigilant.
Protect yourself. By the way, I said what you're looking for to trade up for is a car that averages more than 18 miles a gallon. I said less. You obviously want a better car. That's what you're trading your clunker in for. Mickey Maynard, just in a couple seconds we have. So far, this thing seems to have been complicated, messy maybe, but boffo for the car industry.
Well, 625,000 deals so far, worth $2.58 billion, and it's brought traffic back into showrooms that were literally dead during the spring.
Mickey Maynard of the New York Times. You have till 8 o'clock East Coast time tonight. Mickey, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Robin.
The historical hotbed of America's Industrial Revolution, Lowell, Massachusetts, seems an unlikely place to launch a social experiment in agriculture, but today the city is teeming with recent immigrants from Africa, Latin America, and South Asia, who hunger not only for a leg up economically, but also for a taste of food from their homeland. The New Entry Sustainable Farming Project is luring dozens of urban immigrants into growing organic crops for the market and for their own tables. Producer Chris Burrell has our story from the farm field outside Lowell.
Under the heat of a mid-afternoon sun, Siona Bon Ngufor swings a hoe at the knots of crabgrass that threaten her furrows of peppers and pumpkins.
I weeded just a week ago, but look at it now, you have to weed it back. The hardest thing is weeding.
Just weeds? The 53-year-old from Cameroon won't complain that she just worked an 8-hour shift. She's a nursing assistant in a home for elderly, but as tired as she is, the payoff is vital. It fills her family's plates.
I live with my brother, with my nieces, so all of us eat this vegetable, so that's why I feel happy. When I bring the vegetables, a lot will cook and everybody will be satisfied, because if we go to buy, we'll not have that much, but if it's from the farm, at least we'll get enough.
Almost all the farmers here are poor and arrive with a range of agricultural skills. The New Entry Project, run by Tufts University, gives them a 3-year running start, with land to cultivate, subsidized use of equipment, and free training.
Bottom line is, plant diseases are going to reduce your yield, right? So how are diseases spread?
That's Mackenzie Bookholder, the project's on-site ag expert, a former Peace Corps volunteer in Zambia. Mackenzie says that when it comes to food, immigrants face a whole new world in America.
The folks who are coming to us from Southeast Asia and different parts of Africa, we're used to having food come from 15 kilometers from where they were living. And the huge contrast in coming to America and not knowing where your food comes from is a pretty big thing.
Braids dangle over Nikki Makarutsa's forehead as her right hand sweeps low over leafy pumpkin greens. You won't find pumpkin greens at the local supermarket, but Zimbabweans like Nikki yearn for this vegetable.
That's a delicious food in my country. It's a delicacy. So that's high in iron.
Nutrition ranks high on Nikki's list of reasons for becoming a farmer. She was a middle school teacher in Zimbabwe before she fled the political turmoil 9 years ago. She now works the night shift as a practical nurse and tends to her 4 acres in her off hours. In black rubber boots decorated with white peace signs, she strides from furrows to the outdoor wash basin with a certain gusto.
I work 11 to 7. I go home, take breakfast, come home, take a shower, sleep, go to work. That's the life, 24/7. Doing everything manual, you really need to be at the farm, like, more than your own job.
But farming may soon supplant Nikki's nursing job. She was just given 3 additional acres of land from a nearby church. In exchange, she'll give 8% of her crops to homeless shelters. Her goal? To run her own community-supported farm.
That's my big dream, and I'm not going back about it. Yeah. If it means me delivering door-to-door, if it means we make an arrangement where the customers can come and pick it up, I really want to do it.
She's already given her farm a name, one with roots in her homeland.
It's called Pamzinda. It's a name that means being at home. Quiet, fresh air, plants growing green and so forth, you know. So you can go harvest yourself, and you know, they don't have to come from Pennsylvania or Indiana or go through a lot of truck stops. No, it's right here. I can harvest them in the. That's the feeling that I want. Yeah.
Siona Ban Ngufor knows that desire for home away from home. To till the soil and scrape away weeds, she uses a special tool she brought all the way from her native Cameroon.
When I was coming from home, I put it in my bag with my clothes. So I didn't buy it. I brought it right away from Africa.
Hey, off the farm. I'm waiting to look at it. Hi.
Hello. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm going to go for some of this.
On a recent Saturday at a roadside farmer's market, Siona makes a memory come alive for a customer named Nene, who is an immigrant from Sierra Leone. It happens with a vegetable most Africans know well, a leafy green called amaranth.
I'm going to make stew. Yeah, green stew.
Siona's greens suddenly shrink the thousands of miles that separate Lowell from Freetown. There are smiles on both sides of this farm stand. Nikki witnesses the same event, the cultural chord that resonates when people from far away see the food she grows right here.
Kenyans call it sukumawiki. For what reason, I don't know. I don't come from Kenya. But when they saw it, they all screamed that name, and I'm like, oh, wow, I have it here.
No, for what? Yeah.
No, it's okay.
Oh, it's $5.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
From the first when they come here, they are so surprised, they're so happy. It's never enough. I have to limit them to say, no, you have to take like 10 dozens because we need to give other people, you know. It's really rewarding, just to bring memories to the people, you know.
And to see a slideshow and photos of the New Entry Sustainable Farming Project in action, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Our story was reported by Chris Burrell. And some news notes we're following. Hurricane Bill has moved into the North Atlantic after churning waves that caused 2 deaths here on the East Coast. A 54-year-old man died while swimming in Central Florida. And yesterday, a 7-year-old girl in Maine was killed after she, her father, and another girl were swept into the water at Acadia National Park. 10,000 people had gathered to watch the waves crash into a crevice known as Thunder Hole. Today, NASA's putting the finishing touches on an early morning flight for the Space Shuttle Discovery that's scheduled to blast off tomorrow with a full load of supplies, including a new treadmill named after TV comedian Stephen Colbert. And Alec Baldwin is taking on Senator Joe Lieberman. Baldwin, of 30 Rock fame, told Playboy he's considering running for the Senate seat held by Lieberman. The senator responded on CNN yesterday.
You know, I'll make my day. I mean, but I must say that I respect Alec Baldwin as an actor and as a comedian, and if he wants to run, that's his right.
Joe Lieberman's seat comes up for re-election in 2012. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Here and Now. Remember the Wicked Witch of the West?
Ah, you cursed rat! Look what you've done! I'm melting!
There she goes, melting away in the 1939 film version of L. Frank Baum's Wonderful Wizard of Oz. But author Gregory Maguire couldn't let it go at that. He wanted to know, how did the Green Witch get to be such a, well, witch? In Wicked, Maguire's first book in a series of fairy tales for grown-ups, he concludes, it was the discrimination she suffered. Apparently, it wasn't easy being green for Alphaba Throp, and in reaction to the persecution she saw, she became a passionate animal rights advocate, freeing a caged lion cub during a college science lab, only to later be accused of robbing that lion of his courage. Her stuck-up college roommate went on to become Glinda the Good Witch, and Alphaba was forever tarred as the Wicked Witch of the West. Wicked, of course, became a Broadway hit as well. Alphaba had a son named Lear. His life is explored in Maguire's second book in the series, Son of a Witch. In the third book, A Lion Among Men, well, remember that lion cub Alphaba released back in college? It's his turn. A Lion Among Men is out in paperback this week, and we want to revisit a conversation we had with Gregory Maguire when the book first came out. I asked about the lion's name, Burr.
Well, it is partly because when he was a cub, he shivered so much that that was the sound he made through his flopping, scared little lips. But also, I wanted to tip the hat just a little bit to Bert Lahr.
I do believe in spooks. I do, I do, I do, I do, I do, I do.
I look back at the film, and I see a lion who doesn't look anything like the King of Beasts. He looks like a man in lion pajamas. And I think, what is going on with him? In my novel, I don't say that he's a man in lion pajamas. He clearly isn't. But that was, in a sense, the spur to make me think, who is he behind what we've been told?
Well, he really is a lion, and was perhaps abandoned by his parents. He's not sure, but he, as a cub, he's wandered through the jungle thinking that. And everything he encounters, he screws up.
Well, it took me a while, even writing the book, before I realized it isn't just enough that he happens not to have a lioness or a, you know, a lion king, as it were, a father, to show him the limits and reaches of what it's like to be the king of the forest. He actually grows up without a tribe, so he has to pick up language, such as he does, from the wandering minstrels and lost trappers and soldiers who occasionally skirt through his terrain.
In fact, I want you to do a little reading for us. This is right after one of those soldiers got caught in a bear trap, actually, and dies, even as Burr, you know, is sort of circling him and thinking, well, what should I do? What should I do? You can even hear Bert Lahr, oh, what should I do? Can't do anything. And the soldier dies. But what does happen in that moment is Burr realizes he can talk.
He'd gone 6 days or more, practicing conversational gambits aloud. Hello, I'm very new in town. Hello, are you very in need of a new friend, one with prior experience? When he crossed through a thicket to the edge of a blueberry patch. The fruit hung heavy, cobalt and black and pink, and a small creature, perhaps the size of a human cub, was driving its snout through the offerings. Burr couldn't help himself. "You must be very brave out here all alone in the woods," he began. The cub froze and turned an eye like a blueberry upon the lion. Burr straightened his shoulders and tossed his head to aerate his mane into magnificence, whereupon the cub fell to the ground on its back, its small stained paws cupped below its furry chin. "Sweet Lurlina," said Burr, "I'm slaying them right and left with my conversational wit." He went up to look closely. The cub wasn't dead, but shamming. Burr could see it shaking like a butterfly in a draft.
And the cub wasn't a human cub, but a bear cub of a very forgetful group of bears. Just one of the many encounters that Burr makes. He gets in the middle of, well, it could be called genocide, definitely sectarian violence. violence against trolls. When they're attacked by a mob, Burr, the lion, just folds. One of them says to him, "What kind of a lion are you anyway?" And it's just event after event where he just, whatever, you know, self-worth he had, it just erodes.
What I was hoping to explore in this book was the sense of imprisonment that we all feel, especially recently with developments in chromosomal science, the imprisonment we feel about how much our actions are predictable because of what we inherited from our folks, maybe from our whole species or maybe from our ethnic groups. Given that predictability, is there really anything left of free will?
Because it's expected of a lion that you'll be more than that. But at a certain point when he realizes that he's not going to be that roaring lion, he never expects anything more of himself.
No, that's true. He finds he has a taste for fine art. He has a good eye for prints, and he can make a cozy little business on the side advising ladies of a certain age on how to decorate their salons. He's not much of the lion that we think of in the middle of the jungle.
No, no. Anyway, as the story unfolds, there are also laws that oppress talking animals in Oz in order to avoid jail after a series of events. Burr is sent to track down Yakul the Oracle and find out, answer questions that have to do with your first two books but are presented, you know, stand on their own. What happened to the Wicked Witch's boy, Lear? What does the Clock of the Time Dragon tell us about all of this? The Clock of the Time Dragon, it's this clock with a dragon that gets dragged through Oz.
Yes, and it tells the future a little bit, just as an oracle can tell the future. And there's another way of examining the same question. If oracles can tell the future, if the clock itself can put on little puppet shows that will tell people who are watching what they are like and what they are about to do, then how much free will do we have in the scope of our own lives to make any difference?
Yeah. Gregory Maguire, what are we left to think about the lion when all is said and done?
He is a lot like us in this particular day and age. Oz, for me, seems to be the best metaphor we have for the United States right now. We have this broad land of different parts that is very much focused upon itself and doesn't think about what lives beyond its own boundaries. So the lion, for us, right now, is a kind of citizen stumbling through, partly in thrall to the government, and partly in thrall to his own hopes that he can, in fact, be the savior of his own life.
But he's an animal himself, so there are times when he plays the part of the minority. He thinks that he's made it at a certain point in his life in society, and then he realizes the joke's on him. They don't really accept him at all.
He's a bit of a collaborator. My agent reading this book called me after he reached the last page and said, "He sounds to me like somebody who is still standing in about 1948, having expected not to make it through the early 40s in Europe."
And he had to make a lot of compromises to have made it.
Yes, and he has to live with himself because of knowing what has happened because of the compromises he's made. A lot of the book is a flashback, but when the book starts, he is almost a person who has plea bargained with the government to go do a slightly unseemly job for them in order to avoid being sent to prison. On the way, he decides, maybe I can make this work for me. But he's decided that so many times before, and he's never been able to do it before.
Author Gregory Maguire speaking about the third book in the Wicked Years series, A Lion Among Men. It's out in paperback this week, and we leave you with some of the music from the Tony Award-winning Broadway musical based on his book, Wicked. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us to see what the week brings here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.